everyone, and welcome to Horrorsperia. My name is May, and today I am so excited for the special guest that we have. She has written an incredible book. She is one of my biggest inspirations. But before we get into all of that, let's go ahead and hear from her. Everyone, please welcome Valeria Villegas Lingval.
Hi, May. Thank you so much for having me. I'm going to start believing all the lovely things you say about me.
Valeria, I know so much about you, but do you mind telling us, like, what do you do? What's your background? What's going on?
At present, I'm at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. That's where I'm based. I have been going back and forth from Sweden and Mexico for a while now, but now I'm established here. And while my background, it's perhaps a little bit, I'm not going to say atypical, but maybe like a sort of strange blend of things. Because I mean, originally I'm a film scholar. I specialize in feminist and colonial thought with a very, you know, like keen interest on Latin American horror film and sort of the interplay of, you know, gender, racialization, class, and national identities. But I sort of started doing this in my MA days when I was studying in Stockholm. But in between, I was also a music journalist. So everything sort of like, yeah, it's a facet of my career that I really miss. So I worked for Rolling Stone Mexico for about almost 7 years. Then, you know, transitions of life, and here I am with the doctorate in film studies. But I still with always with one foot on, you know, on pop culture.
Yeah, you've had like every dream job I've always wanted to have. Being a music journalist is maybe like, you know, the dream that I never realized. So that must have been so cool.
Yeah, I mean, I miss it a lot. I have to say, like, one of my favorite things is to sort of have like this kind of conversation. I was really, really looking forward to chatting with you in the podcast. I follow your work, and I think it is also an important thing, isn't it, about, you know, circulating knowledge and making it available in a way that we can make it extensive, if not, you know, sort of like only established in certain circles. And that's something that sort of like, to me, that's something that scratches a little bit of that itch that I have of that music journalism kind of background.
Yeah, totally. Plus, you can submit to music studies calls. Like, you'll get to it eventually. So, I mean, I love you so much, mainly because, like, I remember when I first found your work. I started like in 2019. I came from film production. So I was actually coming from like the filmmaker side, but I realized very quickly that or at least, you know, where I started and whatnot, I hated it. Like, it wasn't supportive for me. And it felt like I was always against something. But when I got more into research and teaching research, I was like, oh, this is what I really want to do. But when I started, it felt like I felt very singular. Like, I'll admit, I didn't know where to look. I was like, where are the other people doing this? I want to meet the other Latin American women that are into horror studies. And you were, I think, like the first one. We met at the Politics of Horror, right? That was the first time we met.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
And it was just like, I remember seeing you pop up. I noticed your name first and I was like, oh my God, it's her. It's one of me. Like, I want to be her best friend. I want to know everything about her. And then like, I learned about your work, which is what we're mostly going to talk about today. You finished your dissertation. It is now a book. How does that feel?
It feels so weird. It feels like, you know, 2000 years ago. It's only been 6 months.
When did you start writing it? Or like, when did the process start?
Well, I sort of started early on in the sense, I mean, I started my PhD in 2017, in the fall of 2017. So I sort of started sketching it very early, I think. But after that, you know how it is, you know, you conceptualize something and then it sort of like starts changing and evolving and so forth. So the process proper, I think, because COVID happened right after my mid-seminar, you know, like the Swedish system has this sort of like Yeah, compulsory seminars, right? Where you present your research, and the mid-seminar is just like, well, ideally you're 50%, where you would be able maybe not to have half the thesis, but at least a good grasp of where you're going. And right in the middle of that, the pandemic struck, and I was extremely anxious. I was very isolated. So it was this very unhealthy, I have to admit, full disclaimer for anyone listening. I mean, I think it is such a, you know, don't feel alone. You know, a PhD journeys can be like this. And I have to admit, it was not, I'm not endorsing that rhythm of work, but it happened so that during the pandemic, like right in 2020, I started revising everything, and it sort of happened in a short period of time. But because I was so adamant to think about, you know, my family in Mexico and everything that was going on with the pandemic. And so on top of that, I was, and I'm sure we might get to the thematic sort of like nitty gritty of it, but I was working on writing in my thesis about violence against women and feminicide. And of course, that sort of was yet another stressor. So I really wanted to work through it. And I sort of ended up in a very sort of like compulsive way of writing. So I reckon that I didn't think I was going to finish by the time that I finished it. And I guess it was like a blessing in disguise in a way, but I am definitely not endorsing that rhythm of work.
I mean, you did it first off, but not only did you do it, it is such an important piece of work. So let's introduce it. So right now I'm looking at the little cover. I know this is an audio, but I love the cover of your dissertation. Oh my goodness. It's so beautiful. So it is called Wicked Women and Witches, Subversive Readings of the Female Monster in Mexican and Argentinian Horror Film. So tell us about that. Tell us your pitch. Like, what is the pitch of this book?
Well, first and foremost, I was thinking, well, for anyone, I'm sure there's going to be maybe a frame of both of our faces in this, but the illustration, I think that, you know, it's a political stance as well. And I will get to the sort of pitch of the book. The artwork, it was developed by Erika Casab. She used to be my student, actually, when I was teaching in Mexico. So I feel incredibly fortunate that she was a person to sort of put her artwork and all of her labor into this commissioned cover and the back cover. And she made this really, really cool portrait of myself that makes me look cooler. So I hope that people are not disappointed when they meet me in person. But everything that is inside as well, that sort of tackles these embodiments of like feminized, often racialized embodiments of like monstrosity, are also illustrated by Mexican artists, all of whom were my students at some point. So we have, it was Ari that also illustrated, Ariana and Mariana, who are graphic artists and are illustrators in their own right. So to me, it was very, very special that the physical and sort of the digital part of it were also kind of that effort, you know, like a feminist exercise as well, where all the labor was, of course, compensated in any, you know, in any way that they wanted me to, you know, they established their rate, and I respect and honor their work, and I feel so incredibly humbled about the fact that they would want to, you know, participate in this. And this, the thesis, in general, as the title sort of like suggests, and one of my colleagues always kind of jokes about the fact that I'm the queen of alliteration, because I love doing that. So Wicked Women and Witches. And originally it was Wicked Women, Witches, and Werewolves. But, you know, constraints of time and space. So I look at the construction of national identity discourses, both in the Mexican-Argentinian context and the ways in which in the case of Mexico, the figure of La Llorona, or the Weeping Woman, had been instrumental to sort of further the role of feminized, racialized, and often impoverished bodies in the grand construction of the Mexican national identity. And in the case of Argentina, I do something similar, but by looking at the figure of La Bruja, kind of like refraining from thinking thinking about it in a sort of like European witch type address and rather look at how these forms of spiritual belief or these forms of knowledge that has to do with the body come to challenge these sort of like pillars of national identity that are preached on, you know, notions of science, Christianity, heterosexuality, whiteness. So all of these are elements that traverse my work. And in order to do that, I do it from the point of view of psychoanalytical recuperations from feminist scholars, which I reckoned was not enough, or it wasn't, well, for, I feel like integrating it as the sole perspective for me wasn't really enough, and it had like limitations in its scope. So so I turned to decolonial thought to sort of disarticulate the ways in which, you know, binary gender and race are colonial inventions, basically.
I'm going to quote from your introduction, because I think to even add on to that, I really love this part of your introduction where what I'm about to read, I think, reaffirms what you just said, but also opens it up to what are the questions you're answering throughout the book. And so you say, this thesis is concerned with the answers to these main questions. What can these wicked women and witches tell us about the languages that made monsters out of them? Can they act as devices to comprehend the systems and discourses that benefit from their ostracization or even their obliteration? And I really love, I mean, it's everything that you just said. It's not that you're just reading the filmic text itself, you're investigating the text in and of itself that built up these concepts. And it's a real, and you do this so expertly throughout the book, where it's a real meticulous devolution almost. And you find so much in breaking it down carefully through language and whatnot. So yeah, maybe can you talk a little bit more about what those questions mean?
Yeah, I mean, so I was, one of the things that I found as I just went on, because interestingly, the thesis was not conceptualized as, you know, embodiments of evil and feminized bodies originally. I had like a larger question that had to do with what was aligned. I mean, of course, this really preliminary sort of stage in your PhD where you're kind of branching in all directions. And I remember the original proposal had to do with embodiments of evil, like generally. And the relation to national identities. And to me, it was very salient and very interesting to see that there was this sort of insistence on thinking through monstrous figures as this sort of figuration or this sort of embodiment of underdevelopment, this sort of, you know, like these kind of associations with Latin America, right? And then the more I dug, the more I realized that these embodiments often sort of conflated feminized, racialized, impoverished bodies. So as I went along, to me, it was very interesting to see that there was always a sort of like repetitive or like this, yeah, this repetitive kind of tactic to have these tropes, right, throughout. And to me, it was interesting and important to establish a historical sort of framework that will allow me to see how they look in different periods of time that also correspond to economic, cultural, and political crisis, which is, I think, a little bit risky as well as a scholar. I'm not presuming that they are like direct consequences of these shifts. However, I do see them as instrumental to sort of reinforce the roles that female or feminized, racialized, impoverished bodies come to fulfill in that sort of keeping that, you know, colonial patriarchal way of articulating our societies, and specifically in Argentina and Mexico. It was very dear to me as well that, you know, these figures that are such a big part of, oh, whatever one can call a national identity, because I mean, of course, Mexico is a fiction and it is a colonial fiction of that. But, you know, however you can graft your national identity, of course, like in my case, it was very interesting to sort of also be confronted from the point of view of the researcher with these you know, distinctly colonial ways of furthering the relationship that we have, or how we make ourselves, how I make myself as a, you know, as a woman performing this particular kind of research and confronting a great deal of these practices that perpetuate or can subvert or can contest ways of organizing knowledge, labor, sexuality, gender, all of these, you know, like different axes of oppression that never act alone. So when I came to revise these figures, I came into this really interesting and sort of like really giving opportunity to even deconstruct a bit stuff that I had grown up with, you know, like these motives of lore, specifically La Llorona or the figure of the witch, which are so incredibly distinct and which I wish to really sort of set in a context where they were vindicated in their own, you know, cultural, political and historical circumstances, to curb and sort of really critically and poignantly look at English written literature. I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I get the feeling that we are also, you know, we overlap a great deal, you and I, in finding these like very otherizing forms of generating knowledge about our cinemas that can come from these kind of like, doesn't feel like an ill intent, right? To say like, oh, you know, it's global cinemas or it is national cinemas or it is these other types of cinemas that are necessarily always like always looked at as some sort of reprisal or some sort of faulty reproduction of forms that are either European or US American. And I really wanted, I mean, I took issue with that. Still yeah. take issue with that.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, I feel like there's so much kinship to your research as well. You're doing important, crucial work, which also comes to confront the fact that, you know, that this notion of Latin Americanness very often also has this really blind spot about the Caribbean. It is a different set of circumstances. We're talking about colonialism in many forms. So to me, to sort of like, to go back, I'm just like straying away from topic, but to go back to the ways in which these articulations of, you know, of the monstrous come to be not only, you know, a cog in that sort of discourse, right? But also, to me, they sort of hold the key of how to resist those, you know, because they are set between binaries constantly.
That was such a beautiful answer. I don't even want to add to it, but no, we do. And that's why I am like, you really are just my inspiration. Cause I'm like, if Valeria could do it, even though she's much smarter than me and so much cooler, I like your work helps give me a framework into, you know, talking about a cinema that isn't even theorized about, you know, Puerto Rican cinemas. Like there isn't a book on it, you know? And so, but that's me anyway. So my point to tie it back to you is your work is so careful in doing that for all the reasons that you said. And I love that you even brought in the idea of how you confront the construct of Latin America. You confront that like right in your first chapter where, you know, you want to be clear that this is the colonial construct, but, you know, acknowledging that is something that you then break down throughout the rest of these chapters, right? And as to, as you say, how it deals with the way that these films are received, the way that these bodies, these feminized bodies are portrayed cinematically. And yeah, I think that it's irresponsible if we don't be careful with those things, because that's essentially what has, in my opinion, I'm going to speak for myself here, I feel like a lot of Latin American studies has just relied on the fact that Latin America is just the given. And that's because the construct was created by these very people. A lot of the people in Latin American studies are colonial in and of themselves. So so it's so exciting and inspiring to see you do that so well. And you do it concisely. You know, your introduction is actually quite short. It's like, it's not, I don't think it rambles on too long. I think that you do so much so concisely. and being like, look, we need to excise these things because the very these very constructs that we're using to analyze and break down the decolonial, the feminist of it, is in and of itself mired in all of these different intersections. And I think that that is something that you do so expertly and like instinctively. And I hope to learn to do that one day. So one thing that I want to do is I do want to give like a little bit of an overview of what your book does. So it is broken down into three chapters, right? And the first chapter is kind of You're making the case for Mexico and Argentina. Like, what are the commonalities? What are the conflicts? Why these two, right? And also introducing La Llorona and the Bruja. Then you spend chapter four looking at La Llorona through Mexico across several films. And then for chapter three, you do the same for Argentina and La Bruja. So I guess to begin to break it down a little bit, do you mind explaining why Mexico and Argentina? Like, why these Latin American countries?
Well, originally, I hope I'm not giving away too much of my future plans, but originally the idea was to cover Mexico, Argentina, and Brazil just purely on the fact that they are sort of industrially have come to represent this sort of like predominance in the Spanish-speaking market. And in the case of Brazil, the only sort of like big referent of Portuguese-speaking narratives in audiovisual culture in Latin America. But then, you know, like as I zeroed in, and I sort of teased it a little bit in the first chapter to sort of track the three countries and the ways that they were sort of adopting cinematic technologies and making a sense out of them. Not, you know, like to tropicalize them, not to just sort of adopt them in a way that was irreflexive, but rather that they started adopting them to their own political ends. And when I started sort of like, you know, teasing that out, I found out something incredibly interesting that I could not find in previous literature, like an explicit link between Mexico and Argentina as these sort of like kindred, but also sort of at odds countries constantly. They have fought, like both countries, industrially speaking, have consistently fought for like the leadership, and very explicitly so, the leadership of the Spanish-speaking, you know, market. I don't like the term, but you know, like that kind of coverage of what comes to represent the point of reference.
I mean, it's true. It's true. Like, we can't, you know, fight it. It's something that I constantly struggle with Puerto Rican media. And I mean, Latin American media does have hegemonies to it. And you're absolutely right. It's Argentina and Mexico.
Exactly. So something that to me was very fascinating in this sort of journey, I sort of started tracing along both countries, was the fact that like the first sound film on both accounts were just like head to head. Like Mexico, you know, like produced its first in 1932, and shortly after Tango in Argentina comes along. And both of them, to me, I mean, Mexico's first sound film was Santa, which is it's an adaptation of a novel by Federico Gamboa that very, very explicitly regulates female bodies by talking about a sex worker that eventually sort of falls from grace, is beyond redemption. It's a very, it's a very depressing story, of course, that, you know, that doesn't quite, and I mean, that was also adapted many times after that. And there was even, you know, the latest was a telenovela. I mean, it was incredibly successful. And to me, that first was very interesting to think that these mobilizations of the role of women in a modernity that was distinctly patriarchal, that was distinctly teleological, that had its endgame in progress, was supposed to be conveyed through the traumatic story of a sex worker beyond redemption, right? And that was the first one. And then when I saw Argentina's, you know, effort at its first sound film, it's also distinctly nationalistic. It's called Tango, and it sort of like underlines the idea of, like, even was, you know, promoted in its materials as this film is spoken like the way that we speak, and the reference to tango as this like very specific form that is also a blend of very of European and autochthonous vocabularies, musically speaking. To me, it was so, so interesting that they were sort of like chasing each other constantly. And the same happened in horror films. So when I found that out, it was like this kind of, hidden gem moment, because I had realized that there was no previous literature. And I mean, of course, I sort of dug and dug, and I could be wrong. There's always, you know, that prerogative as a researcher saying, oh, maybe I had a blind spot. I don't believe I had. I really made sure. But at that time, at the moment, I realized that there was no account specifically of that, you know, sort of correspondence. And to me, much more than being a rivalry, because this is how it was articulated for many years, right? Like this sort of fighting for the leadership in the Latin American market, much more than a rivalry, I just saw it as a very distinctive sort of dance between both countries. And I love that idea that it is not that there is this sort of contentious relationship anymore. As a matter of fact, I mean, horror film has allowed both countries to thrive in sort of cooperations. And we have many, Adrián García Boliviano is a great example of that. He's Argentinian. He has worked consistently in Mexico and Spain. So, you know, that sort of kinship, I think, was so facilitated by genre film. And to me, that is just only testament to the fact that genre film is a political genre, and that we, you know, we can find however many IMDb reviews saying we want to keep our, you know, we want to keep our horror free from your gender studies agenda. You feminists, you decolonial thinkers, you know, like this sort of backlash is something that feels very passé, because the genre has done that for many decades. So to find that in the way that both countries were sort of like constantly not trying to best each other, but rather, you know, constructing this sort of relationship with their very own specific sets of trauma that respond to militarism, which is just like like colonial patriarchy gone completely wrong and bananas, right?
Yeah.
So all of these sort of like commonalities to me were so, they were like one more opportunity to sort of see the kinship and see how they were related, you know, beyond the fact that they both cinemas, you know, in terms of genre are so keen on depicting monstrous women.
Absolutely. That was so well articulated. So more for curiosity, out of just because I'm curious, when you started your track in 2017 and you said it was Brazil, Mexico, and Argentina, was that always clear to you from the beginning, or did you narrow it down through, like, did you have a bigger idea at first?
Well, it was kind of clear in the sense that I could see that they had their own sort of traits when it comes to their distinctive, you know, like the ways of making genre film, like both horror and fantasy and sometimes sci-fi. But I think, I mean, ultimately, I'm not going to lie, there's not a lot of, you know, like one of the reasons why I couldn't include Brazil was the fact that, you know, nobody wants to read like a 500,000 word dissertation. Yeah. And of course, you know, like time and space and that sort of, those sorts of constraints kept me always in the straight and narrow when it came to, you know, like having a very specific thread. And I found that relating both Argentina and Mexico was perhaps easier also for comprehension to see a very specific focus. But I think it was most of this sort of process of being, you know, like sort of tracking, always flirting with other lines of thought, but always thinking that you need to narrow it down so the reader is also, you know, so ultimately it's impactful and has, yeah, you know, like evidence.
That makes perfect sense. So now, you know, I hope that some people that are listening to this have no idea who you are. That way they can go and learn about you, and you just grow more followers and start a cult, which I will be vice president of. So La Llorona, I know what she's about. You're the expert, but do you mind explaining, like, who is La Llorona? Why is she so important in Mexico? And how did you tackle that chapter? You know, let's talk a bit about La Llorona.
La Llorona is one of these figures that, I mean, while Mexican folklore doesn't have the monopoly on it, because there are so many different kind of iterations in other places. And Milagros Palma, she's an anthropologist, right? So she put together this really interesting study where she also looks at the ways in which this figure sort of reiterates in Nicaragua, Colombia. So, you know, like, and I mean, I love the idea that the sort of lore is also, you know, Central America also had like Panama has La Tulivieja, you know, like the Dominican Republic has La Ciguapa, like all of these figures that are sort of kindred and gravitate around this idea of a woman who in several versions, you know, sort of very generally, because it varies from place to place and it also varies from version to version, but generally it's told as a story of an indigenous woman who, you know, to facilitate this idea that Mexico is this rich place where we have, you know, Spanish meets indigenous and they all happily lived ever after. It sort of hinges on this idea that a Spanish man falls in love and they have like these crazy romance, right? Telenovela sort of. And then, you know, she has one or several kids. I mean, yeah, depending on the version. And this man leaves her for a woman of his own background. So she is completely, you know, like heartbroken. As a consequence, she kills her children. She kills herself rather than suffer that humiliation of, you know, being exposed as the other woman and the Spanish person. And the version sort of, you know, is transformed in different ways and it pops up in a great deal of literature that discusses the sort of nuances of Mexican identity, because it comes to sort of encapsulate this idea of the interaction of mestizaje, this idea of miscegenation, but that inevitably is traversed by, you know, by rape and genocide. So of course it can either be this vehicle whereby we have this sort of romantic notion about, you know, the woman that laments her children because it was her who transgressed, not the person that left her alone, not the person that potentially raped her, you know, but rather it was her, you know, like, and I found it so profoundly interesting in a setting that it trades on the vocabulary of the crime of passion, you know, which is a completely patriarchal, you know, I won't swear, I promise, but it's a patriarchal construct, this idea that, you know, gender violence is the sort of thing excusable through passions that happen to be just misogyny. And, you know, confronting this sort of myth and seeing how it was a useful tool to sort of look at her whale. I mean, she is widely known by her whale, "Ay, mis hijos," you know, "Oh, my children." And, you know, to me, it was very significant to think about speech and language as these forms that cannot, I mean, that can mean resistance, that crying or wailing can also be a means of resistance. And in that, I was very inspired by Nelson Maldonado Torres, thinking through, well, he recuperates Franz Fanon, but thinking through the ways in which when a racialized body, a feminized body, an impoverished body is denied all sort of like ontological weight, like subjectivity, a cry or a whimper or a wail is a sign of humanity, right? Like that is the only thing afforded to that body in the grand scheme of things, you know, in a structure that is colonial and patriarchal and not in origin. So to me, see the recurrence of these motifs. So I track it through. There are many of these films that deal with it in Mexican visual culture, but our very first horror film with sound was about La Llorona. It was 1933. So to me, that was no small, you know, fact or a coincidence. It was rather this sort of very specific effort, an attempt to solidify what the modern Mexican came from, like where the modern Mexican came from, this sort of idea of mestizaje as the banner of the nation. And to me, it was very interesting to see how this kind of transforms, right? Like from this woman who is callous and horrible, that is capable to kill her children rather than, you know, either suffer humiliation or being with this man that doesn't love her or, you know, whatever the version. Rather than that, to see her as this figure that has been wronged, You know, and it is, of course, not something that I came up with. It is something that comes from one of my biggest inspirations, Gloria Saldúa, when she talks about like La Llorona being a mother as well, for those that are deterritorially, like that are displaced territorially. So to me, it was also recuperating the ways in which this figure comes to offer some sort of resistance to that sort of, you know, and her wail to me is no longer scary. Her wail to me is still her trying to cling to, you know, to that humanity denied. So I tracked it in that film from 1933 by Ramón Peón. Then there is one from Rafael Valedón in 1961. I mean, it varies. Usually it is quoted either 1961 or 1963, depending on who you ask. The Curse of La Llorona, La Maldición de La Llorona, and then the latest version that I revise, which is not explicitly La Llorona, but I do believe that it's sort of, it can be understood as such, which is Tigers Are Not Afraid, that was very popular with the critic, by Isa López, that revises what I see as, you know, the most contemporary avatar of La Llorona, a woman that is dispossessed by this, you know, rampant capitalist logic through the narco and through drug dealing as a mode of surviving, but also, as Sayek Valencia says, like some sort of like this sort of reiteration of colonial forms through hyper-consumerism, through hyper-violence, through gore, because that is the reality that, you know, that we've come to be so familiar with. I mean, I haven't lived in Mexico for a bit now. I have been based in Sweden now for, you know, half a decade. That's not too shabby. But, you know, going back and forth, of course, for the best part of the 2000s, that being like a fixture of our reality, you know, drug dealing and gore as a mode of existing and as a mode of articulating and as a mode of relating to each other. So to me, that was incredibly difficult to write. But I do believe that La Llorona provides that sort of figure that is flexible and that is updated in its function to understand that sort of expendability that in the grander scheme of things, like in colonial patriarchal modes of articulating Mexico, because that's what it is, comes to encapsulate all of these disposable bodies, right? Bodies that are considered to be expendable. So at large, that was sort of the intention of recuperating this figure as a relevant point of entry to understand the function of these bodies, you know, and in this kind of discourse of nationality, but also to envision other futures, you know, it's to envision other ways of resisting.
That is so well said. Right now I'm paging through the chapter and like seeing you almost like hit that right in order, and it's really beautiful. How do you feel, if you can speak to this, and I think you can, but if you don't feel comfortable speaking to this, that's okay. How do you feel Mexican audiences have responded to these revisions? Like, do you, as you say, you spoke about a future, which was really interesting to me. So I want to latch on to that bit of what you just talked about. Like, do you, yeah, what do you think about these revisions affecting the spectatorship of Mexico? Or does it?
You mean like in terms of the latest sort of films that convey this sort of thing?
Well, I guess, yeah. So like you establish this very well in your book about how the figure of the La Llorona, you know, how it tied to the nation building throughout the cinema and whatnot, and these myths of mestizaje that we have. But then how in more recent films, you know, it's become more of a symbol of resistance, kind of breaking down, you know, almost like a reclamation of La Llorona, which I'm so happy that you point out distinctively, because when I knew about La Llorona, you know, years and years ago, it was always presented to me as like I think the subtitle of this chapter is like the bad mother of femininity. I don't want to misspeak, but I mean, like, you weren't supposed to sympathize with her, right? La Llorona is the evil that comes to our home. But as you say, like that is completely, you know, not or the reality that you know, it's a construct basically. But with these later revisions, it makes me wonder how the perspective of La Llorona has shifted in Mexico, if it has.
Yeah, I mean, I think what is fascinating to me is that I think about La Llorona and I think it lends itself so well to think through what does it mean to exist as a woman or someone who is perceived as a woman in Mexico in contemporary, you know, like settings. And I see that as a virtue of Vuelven, of Tigers Are Not Afraid, even though most of the time the critic, both national and international, doesn't really, you know, discuss it in terms of that figure. And right. I might have gone a little bit wild in that one, but I do believe that it is an unfolding of La Llorona in the sense that it is a forcefully made Llorona. It is, I don't want to, you know, like take away from the impactful and really directly traumatic notion of what it is to exist as a woman in Mexico in general. And of course, much more as a racialized woman, as an impoverished woman, or as anyone that can be read as such, or as a queer person, or as a non-binary person. So thinking about all of these violences that traverse these bodies constantly, to me, it was so fruitful to think about Tigers Are Not Afraid as a representation of La Llorona made distinctly in the context of the war on drugs, which it hasn't really ended, but the ripples of its violence still go on. And I find it to be really productive. I find it to be provocative that this is the first time that, you know, a female director gets so much attention, but that, you know, La Llorona is not quite the focus, but right. A little bit before. And the reason why I bring this up is that there have been other articulations of La Llorona. One of them, also directed by a woman, that was kind of, I mean, it's not discussed as much, Las Lloronas, which is from 2004 by Lorena Villarreal. I didn't have the chance to cover it, but I do think that it's sort of, I mean, it is at the beginning of the 2000s, right? So I feel that, you know, in the grander sort of chronology of things, it starts to signal the ways in which perceptions of La Llorona change and the way in which it does this. I mean, it is more of a like sort of family drama type deal that deals with some supernatural sort of like latches on to this like idea of La Llorona as an intergenerational curse that happens to a family, specifically a middle class, upper middle class kind of family. And the ways in which the women in that family communicate. So to me, that was very, I mean, however little discussion there is about it, to me, that starts to signal a shift on the idea of how we sympathize with La Llorona as this woman that has really no recourse to the violence. One of the instances in this film is that one of the women is suffering, you know, from domestic abuse, and she has to resort to violence. So all of these instances in which this kind of aggression and this kind of violence that seems to be, you know, reserved only for men in this grander scheme of things happens to be a resource of women. With all that's problematic, you know, like instances, I'm not going to unfold the film itself, but it starts signaling to a degree of empathy that we can establish with the figure that to me is not always present in previous films, even though I read, for example, The Curse of La Llorona, Against the Grain, the one from the 60s, because I don't believe that she's a monster. I believe that she is a badass. you know, to return to your question, during the 2000s, I can sort of more readily see that sort of transformation. And then a couple of years after, I believe it's 2006, Kilometer 31, that was also very well received, by Rigoberto Castañeda, it has a second part, but that also allows us to see La Llorona as this sort of like haunting, that is always a haunting of reckoning, that is not, you know, like just senseless violence. It is not senseless, you know, fear or aggravation, but rather she is sort of the reminder of something that went wrong. And even though it sort of detaches itself a little bit from the traditional iconography of La Llorona, to me, it starts signaling, you know, like it sort of continues with the shift. Then we have like a seeming silence. And of course we have Vuelven that comes out, 2018, I believe. And of course, even though it's not a Mexican film, Jairo Bustamante's La Llorona, that is an exceptional film that comes to very explicitly, you know, use the figure to discuss instances of genocide and of indigenous genocide that is a matter that remains unresolved and that it is a matter facilitated by, you know, colonial intervention and U.S. American imperialism. So, of course, to me, it was just like I was so excited when I watched that film because to me, it opens that sort of political question about how these figures have been co-opted by, especially La Llorona, by these kind of, you know, colonial patriarchal notion of women being evil, very Christian that as well. and it flips it around. And perhaps an interesting tidbit is that Maria Coroy, the woman that plays the sort of like haunting figure, she also played Malinche in a series by Canal 11 in Mexico. And Malinche just very, you know, quickly, she's sort of like in that kind of construct of how Mexico came to be. It's usually articulated as, well, she was an indigenous woman, documented to have been translator and then lover of invader Hernán Cortés. But usually, you know, kind of the scapegoat. Like, she was the whore. She was the person that allowed this to happen. She was a vulnerable point when, you know, and when this figure was vindicated in visual culture in a different way, where the character is shown speaking her own language, the short series also have a number, has a number of indigenous languages spoken at the time. It's also spoken in Latin. It's very interesting. It's also played by Maria Coroy, the person that was Bustamante's Llorona. So to me, that's sort of a full circle, right? It is a way to go back to this kind of co-opting of the figure co-opting of the figure with patriarchal and colonial ends to sort of allow it to speak in a different way.
Yes, I want to read from your chapter. This is your ending sentences, just because I think they're so beautiful. You say, La Llorona overflows the normative notion of Mexicanidad by exposing its fractures as a discourse steeped in ethnic exclusion and misogyny, underlining the impossibility of containing the pain she conjures. The fluidity of her presence can allow for a counter-reading that grants her visibility, bringing her to light after centuries of occlusion and rescuing her from the perennial spectacle of female suffering, erasure, and punishment. A little clap for that. That's just so good. Before we move on, just because I'm curious, this is a bit of a shit post question. Did you ever see The Curse of La Llorona?
Oh boy, did I ever. Yes.
Can you tell? I never wanted to see it because I just imagined it would be really racist and awful. Was I right?
Yes, you were not wrong, my love.
So for context, it's an American film directed by some asshole whose other movies I also hate.
But yeah, so I did, and hopefully soon enough, you know, knocking on wood, a piece that I wrote about it.
Really? Yes, I can't wait. You were right, by the way, Michael Chavez. He also did the most recent Conjuring, which is why I had it, which was also shit, but anyway, continue.
I mean, I always have a very hard time thinking about films specifically of The Conjuring, like that sort of franchise that I believe has a great deal of, you know, critique that can be directed at it, but it's also distinctly, you know, patriarchal bullshit through and through. I have a very hard time sort of thinking about some sort of like, oh, you know, like feminist recuperation of it, because I feel like a lot of it is disposed, it's sort of set up in that way, right?
Yeah.
The Curse of La Llorona was particularly, you know, like, ugh, to me. It's very cringy. First, it sort of centers this idea of a Mexicanness that can either be associated with its extreme whiteness, right? It centers its story around Linda Cardellini, who's, you know, like sort of association with Mexicanidad or Latinidad or however you want to articulate it is through, she's a widow of a police officer who happened to be Latino or Mexican. They don't really, you know, like they sort of conflate us all in the same bag first.
Okay.
and they sort of like have this idea of, you know, the La Llorona as this sort of like curse that is broken upon or that starts acting upon this family and the two children that they have, you know, you know, never mind that supposedly the figure in the film is just like murderous and horrible and, you know, and is already sort of wreaking havoc in a Latino family, but that's not important. The moment that it touches upon this family, it just becomes like a real, you know, shit gets real. And that implication to me was just like, okay, I get what they're trying to do. But to me, it was such a transparent effort right in the juncture of, you know, like mass deportations that have never really ended. But it was right in the moment when these attention centers came to light as also exercising forceful hysterectomies on immigrant women. Like all of these matters are just a juncture, right? And then you have a film that depicts the ultimate, you know, xenophobes, you know, like racist asshole paranoid fantasy of an immigrant that cannot be contained because she is La Llorona and she's like this specter, right? So you cannot contain that sort of immigrant. It's like the most noxious way of the immigrant, of the racialized immigrant, of course.
Mic drop.
So I swear it was just very, you know, like to me, it was so transparent of an effort. And I, you know, I've been talking with friends and colleagues, this idea that they wanted to make it accessible to Latino markets, right? Like this idea of we're going to mobilize a story that you're familiar with and something that will be a selling point. But it's such an insulting and condescending one at that, you know? And, you know, looking upon it, and you're going to love this, when it opened, and that I also found profoundly aggravating. There are like different accounts of people from the press that went to the opening because it opened at South by Southwest. And they did this sort of like ritual, right? So they dispatched like several like alleged, because I don't know, I can't claim that they were curanderos and traditional healers to sort of like bless the audience and a Cuban healer in this sort of like spectacle that to me was extra aggravating, sort of conflating everything, you know, everything is wrong.
Yeah, no.
But conflating, you know, like all these spiritual beliefs, because all of us Latinos are incredibly superstitious. And of course, it comes from this colonial place of like any other alternative spiritual practice is ignorance or is dangerous. It's only profitable or it's only good as long as it is put at the service of whiteness, which is essentially what the film does. Like,
oh, man. Exactly. That was just so beautiful. Like goosebumps.
So I was so aggravated about that because they did like a limpia, you know, like this sort of cleansing to the audience.
So fucked up. What the fuck? I believe it. I'm believing it, making it real, starting the rumor here. No, that's a lot.
Yeah, and the gesture is also reprised in the film. Like they have this dude, I don't remember his name at the moment, but he's the same guy that played Tuco in Breaking Bad.
Oh, shut the fuck up. I know him.
So he plays like this kind of like priest gone rogue and he's a curandero. And of course, he's going to help his family to attain this and that. But he's also like a pathetic comedic relief to it.
No, yeah. And also, he's like such a recognizable figure in American pop culture now. Yeah, no. I mean, you confirmed all of my suspicions. But in a way, to kind of pivot to something that you just said about, you know, Latin Americans, you know, being very superstitious and the way that we all have our different customs, I think that this is a really great transition to your final chapter, which is on the witch term bruja from Argentina. Now, the interesting thing for me, even though La Llorona is overall a Latin American legend, like, yes, whatever that means, to me, she's very much, for me, her lineage is very much Mexican. Like, that's just always the way that I perceive her. But bruja and brujería in Latin America is conceived so differently regionally. Like the brujas in the Caribbean are entirely different from the brujas in, you know, Central America and Argentina. So do you mind explaining what version of the bruja, like the Argentinian bruja? Let's talk about her. Let's get into it.
Essentially where I started exploring or teasing out the like notions that have to do with national identity in Argentina, I sort of started tracing it to the very young, you know, republic that it became in the 1800s. And a lot of one of these really salient sort of discursive tools to talk about it was just civilization and barbarism, right? Civilization as aligned to this kind of colonial enterprise of the post-colonial Argentina as a democracy, so forth, modeled after European notions of progress. and barbarism of as everything that they had to pave over in order to establish this sort of form of government and of policy and of, yeah, and a biopolitical kind of regime. So when I saw that, to me, it was very interesting that the Bruja was always sort of like treading that line, like being able to deal with both sides, this sort of like constant threat. And how I came to sort of separate it or to think through it as a distinct form was incidentally, because at the time when I started sort of conceptualizing everything, that's right when Princess Nokia released Brujas, fabulous song. I love it. I quoted it in the chapter. But it's sort of like a really, it really got me thinking about how, you know, brujería specifically, you know, she's talking about the Caribbean and that particular, and that particular song, which I think it's an anthem of sorts, as a form that comes as a reconciliation or as a resistance that is diasporic in origin. In that particular case, you know, like a lot of forms of Afro-diasporic, like spiritual belief and exercises, which is something that is also so prevalent in Argentina. However, this kind of effort of thinking through these forms as something that is sort of solidified in the past, or something that belongs to barbarism, or that is incompatible with modernity, really gave me sort of like set the tune for me to distinguish it from this, you know, ideas of the European witch, which are very popular, and specifically since I'm trying, you know, like, and I'm approaching it from a decolonial feminist point of critique, which are always kind of like, which are, well, not always, but very often at odds, right? A lot of decolonial thinkers would never really understand themselves aligning with feminism as a liberal practice, as a white practice, and I completely understand that stance. I prefer to think about it as anti-patriarchal in origin, to sort of like remove a little bit of that. But you know, when I was, it was also sort of all of the juncture in which this happened that facilitated the process of me understanding it as the Bruja and resisting calling it a witch, even though in the title, of course, it has to be like that because it is recognizable. The other fact is that when I was sort of teasing this out, right, and putting it in terms of the national identity discourse belonging to Argentina in this kind of like dictum of civilization or barbarism, the revival, or like a clearer revival of witch feminism started to take shape. A lot of it coming from US American writers. I am not, you know, trying to be disrespectful. I'm trying to be critical and putting, you know, like putting the sound arguments where they belong. And that's just like my opinion, man. But a lot of it, I kept finding this limitation of it being so unbearably white feminist. Like this rhetoric about like, I'm the witch, I am a witch, and we are the granddaughters of the witches you couldn't bear. When there was also a great deal of racial privilege in that sort of stance. So if we're going to look at the painful parts, let's look at them to be accountable on both sides. Because I mean, of course, mestizaje in Latinidad can also be an extension of whiteness. And you know, in that respect, how much are we also sort of like making a division in the division? I'm not saying that I have all the answers to this, but my articulating it as a bruja was kind of a response to that, you know, that kind of boost of witch feminism that recuperates, oh yeah, you know, like the suffragettes and Susan B. Anthony, let's talk about her as, you know, the ultimate witch. It's just like, yeah, I mean, but she was also incredibly anti-Black, like, And it's okay. You know, these historical figures do not have to be beyond reproach. Nobody has to be. However, occluding these sorts of things and sort of choosing to uplift only certain parts of it is just as complicit as not mentioning it, I believe. So unfortunately, something that didn't make it to the journey thinking through it, but that was very useful for me at the defense as well, was Kyla Schuler's The Trouble with White Women, because it came right when I finished, but it puts it in much better words than I could, with less swear words, but no swear words. It sort of illuminates the ways in which I think it speaks really clearly to my hesitance to think through this like as a European witch, you know? Because as we know, also colonial processes happened in a very different way. And the Inquisition happened in Latin America and in the Caribbean, but they had very different implications. And a lot of autochthonous and also after that, like Afro-diasporic spiritual practices still remain. So to me, to think about them as relics of the past is just as, you know, limiting as thinking about La Llorona as this kind of like ignorant myth that is just like surviving in the past, because these are all sort of like simultaneous realities and temporalities, right? I really did not want to sort of like fall into that thought about thinking about the witch as the ultimate feminist bastion, because I think that also has its limitations. So in thinking about the Bruja, to me, it really did open a great deal of possibilities that was not foreclosed, you know, in thinking through our kind of like general idea of the witch a la, you know, like Sabrina or something of the sort.
So well articulated. I mean, I'm in awe. So in your chapter, you tease through the Bruja in Argentina through the films Embrujada, which was directed by Armando Bó from 1969. And then you pull it into the more modern times with Habitaciones para Turistas from Adrián García Bogliano from 2004, and Luciferina from directed by Gonzalo Calzada from 2018. So do you mind maybe talking a little bit about the witch archetype, the Bruja archetype across these films and, you know, some takeaways?
I realized, like, you know, that was always the part that was a little bit more difficult to establish the thread, because it is a very wide historical period. Embrujada, to me, it's sort of like this thread, right? Like of the notion of how the body and its knowledges are policed. So thinking through indigeneity, which is a vital part of Embrujada, we'll just get to that in just a moment. And then how these managing of the body and its knowledges by the state comes to have like a brutal form, which later takes the form of military dictatorships, of which Argentina underwent two in a very short period of time, brutal parts that, of course, exercise their power, and, you know, militarism as the ultimate patriarchal exercise of power, of course, extended to body sovereignty, which is something that is depressingly relevant right now with what is happening.
Yeah.
We'll get to that, because it is so incredibly symptomatic. I think we're all, I am enraged. It was very tough to learn what is happening on your end. And I'll be completely frank. Sweden is not, is not impervious to flirting with those like sort of like right wing ideas of mm-hmm. what we should do with our bodies. And it is, right. It is a scary time.
It is.
At the same time, it is a moment where, you know, like negotiation, and sort of like giving the benefit of the doubt feels, you know, it feels like that time is over, right?
Yeah. Anyway,
but going back to that, so I connected it to Habitaciones and Luciferina because they both speak to the management of the body, one of them discussing abortion and the other one discussing forced disappearance and abortion, enforced abortion, exercised by this kind of allegorical the arm of the dictatorship in the 70s. So to me, they are sort of like a continuation of that policing of the body, of its knowledges, and of its capability of giving birth and of feeling pleasure. So the first film that I addressed, Embrujada, was also a little bit of my love letter to Isabel La Coca Sarli, who was this figure. I mean, there is this exceptional study by Victoria Ruetalo, who specializes in the ways in which nationality came to be negotiated in the body of La Coca, like as this kind of cult sex star. And in the film, she is kind of coded as an indigenous person. She wasn't, the actress wasn't, but it is a film that is released in 1969, and it's canned many years because, you know, there was a dictatorship going on at the time, and it was released much after. But the film sort of establishes continuation to a much earlier film. I mean, a film that Sarli and Bo made 9 years before, where you have like this sort of encounter of Ancisse, who is the woman that she's portraying there, as this indigenous woman that is seduced by a man from the city. And, you know, they fall in love and all these beautiful things happen. And of course, there's a lot of nudity, but it's always very implied. And then by the time we reach Embrujada, it's just like complete frontal nudity and, you know, more like a softcore sort of porn take on it that was very trademark of Armando Bó. But to me, what was very interesting is that the film does two things that are not, they're kind of salient. One of them, it features a figure of Guarani lore. I mean, that is sort of like in this particular part of Misiones, you know, bordering Paraguay, Argentina, Brazil, El Bombero, which is like this figure that is usually hyper-masculine, that is known for impregnating women, that is often associated by many with blackness. So to me, it was very interesting that they just do that with an exceptionally, you know, crappy mask. And if you Google it, I think you're going to love it. So El Bombero is sort of as a signal to these unfoldings of Afro-diasporic belief, of autochthonous belief, and how her pleasure is sort of centered constantly in the film. And she's accused constantly of being a witch. This woman is just like this indigenous woman that is really, that she regrets having done that, you know, having married a man of the city, having become this sort of jet set trophy wife, and she wants to have a kid. So a lot of these like instances in which she has sex with everyone that just like comes along her path, including a supernatural entity, Romero, is because she is like, you know, hellbent. She wants to have a child and she really doesn't give a shit how. But in doing that, I found something interestingly, you know, transgressive, that all these bodies that are highly regulated, like she comes to just like completely, you know, undo all these, like, I don't give a shit. I'm just going to go and, you know, like she becomes a sex worker, for example. She refuses to be paid. But the only payment, like if I have a child as a product of this, it's going to be great, you know? So all of these that just undo and kind of spit in the face a great deal of her marriage, of the notion of respectability of her, you know, as an indigenous woman that was made, you know, like this respectable figure in her community by marrying a timber mogul. All of that is undone very much on her own accord. And, you know, even though there is sort of this ambiguous suggestion that she just loses it by the end because she kills every man in her path. She never becomes a mom. Even if the suggestion is like veiled that, oh, she lost everything that she had, she exercised power that is uncharacteristically uncharacteristically hers. And weaponizing sexuality to me was also a very interesting idea of how the witch, also how we traditionally know it as, you know, a presence that defined by excess and defined by, you know, like excessive desire in a way, you know, like some sort of sexual potency that she is allowing herself and she's procuring herself. It sort of comes to be vindicated, not without its problematic, you know, aspects. But to me, that was very, very interesting of a way to see this kind of alternative figure of the witch that is latching on indigenous belief, that is latching onto, I won't give too much away, but I also deal a bit with the ways in which the figure can also be read as an unfolding of El Bombero within the context of Umbanda, which is an Afro-diasporic, you know, like spiritual practice that still is very much alive in Argentina and Brazil, but that was very highly regulated and very maligned, part of like their satanic panic equivalent in the early 90s. So to me, that was very, you know, it was revealing to think about the ways in which these forms that are very patriarchal in origin, that Bo was insistent in having her to be eye candy. And it is very, you know, well known that he was a terrible person to her. They were together, like sentimentally, for a number of years and exploited her to no end, made her work under horrible conditions. And even though, you know, even when this film comes as kind of like his brainchild, to me, it's fantastic that we can recuperate it as the films of La Coca. I mean, they are no longer Armando Wolves. They are Nago Gus films. And then, you know, I go on to more contemporary films, that deal with the idea of the witch as an abortionist. Whether condemned in Habitaciones para Turistas, which was Adrián's first film. And it sort of marks the shift about the body, its regulation in contemporary Argentina, which just decriminalized abortion very recently, after years of struggling to do so. And the film portrays a very grim sort of, it's kind of like a slasher film, portrays a very grim idea of women being, yeah, like chased pretty much, chased and killed and, you know, by this kind of like religious secty type government of this really small place, San Ramon. And how all of this seems to be an allegory, right, of this kind of entrapment of bodies that are not allowed to procure an abortion, because all these young women are trying to procure an abortion, but they just got there to be slain, essentially. And to me, it was, of course, very much in tune with the debate about the decriminalization of abortion that was happening at the time. And finally, Luciferina, which is Gonzalo Calzada's film from 2018, that also signals to the fact that, you know, Argentinian horror film is well and good, very healthy in its state. It was incredibly profitable. Like his work now, he released Nocturna, I think, a year ago. And, you know, like sort of both him and Adrián and Pablo Paredes and all these figures that have come to be staples of Latin American genre filmmaking demonstrate the ways in which, I believe, they are sort of distinctly claiming a place in horror, you know, visual culture. And the film, this other film does it in a way that feels that it's more of a gothic adaptation. So there the witch is more of this kind of perverse coven of witches that exercises, you know, very horrible, or yeah, that does really horrible things to young women in an island called Tigre, which is, well, it's not an island, it's like this kind of the northernmost part of Buenos Aires, where incidentally, I mean, one of the findings was that there was a detention center during the dictatorship there in Tigre, Silencio. And to me, it was very interesting because it features a sort of ruinous environment, thinking through how to reclaim the ruin as a way to also reclaim all those silences exercised by state terrorism and violence. And the film sort of deals with the idea of pregnancy and conception as ways to establish, or at least what I post in the chapter, as ways to establish a different kind of temporality, which I believe is completely, you know, it is very tied to the female body in that case, you know, like establishing a temporality that eludes the idea of colonial, you know, patriarchal, linear time. So that was kind of like essentially where I was coming from. It is more of a diverse chapter, but it sort of touches upon the ways in which colonial patriarchal ways of policing the body, its pleasures, its knowledges, its capabilities to reproduce or to choose not to, are so entirely tied. And they're the scaffolding of national identity. I mean, it is one of its cogs, right? So to me, it was sort of like a progression, even though it seemed a little bit, you know, spread out in time. It is a progression not only of that matter, but also of industrial modes of production, like from an exploitation film, or a sexploitation film, to more formalized, you know, like well-established modes of production, state-sponsored, and so on. So it sort of contains that kernel of industrial history as well.
Thank you for that, by the way. I think you did that so excellently, concisely, considering how much ground you covered. And I think, you know, it's everything that you just said, but to also tie this to La Llorona, one of the things that you wrote in your Bruja chapter was how the Bruja in Argentinian audiovisual culture is the bastion of the many freedoms left to recover. But I also, you know, that's also in La Llorona, really. And really, that's like, if you were to condense, you know, your intention, or maybe one of the many intentions of your thesis and your dissertation and your wonderful book, it's really seeing how these feminine, you know, genre icons are the metaphor to the feminine bodies in these countries, right? And about how they're still so regulated. And you know, you gave a lot of really good context with the narco violence in Mexico, and you just gave us a lot of great context with Argentina. But I think, you know, to pull from the larger, yes, this is about movies, but really it's about how institutions still threaten these feminized bodies and don't you know, how we you know, as bearers of these bodies, find resistance and community, and honestly sometimes even just the will to live and try to exist in these societies across many transcultural even and transnational influences. Like, I know you alluded to the Supreme Court decision being overturned because I'm in America, but as you say, you know, how this affects in Sweden, and then how this affects your perspective when you go off to home in Mexico. It's a lot, but you know, you do such a good job. You know, it's hard to find, I think, like, for me, it's really hard to find silver lining sometimes, being a bearer of a feminine body and whatnot, and being within Latin America, especially Latin America that is often ignored. But seeing how well you articulate this throughout your book, it's such an amazing book, and seeing also, you know, your other work that you're doing, you know, and whatnot, I think to me it's the hope, right? Because what else are we gonna do, right? or I don't know how you feel. That wasn't really a question, it's just sort of like, just like, wow, so impressive. But also it's like, it's also just like a lot. Like, it is so impressive because we deal with a lot.
First, it is very kind of you to say that. Aside from the academic, I mean, you and I have been in touch for a while now, and I can't stress how much I treasure the fact that we found each other, because, you know, like, universities and academia being the type of institution that is originated in that sort of, like, colonial sort of, like, structure of how we generate knowledge, and what is supposed to be arbitrary, this, you know, valid knowledge, can be a very isolating instance where, you know, you feel a little bit like free-floating, as you said, a little bit, you know, on your own.
Can I interrupt really quick with a question? Because I think it's going to build. Like, did you ever have moments of, like, crying or breaking down during your research process involving this because you're so personal to the work?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I cried like a baby. Like, there's still this a particular passage in the dissertation that it is very hard for me not to cry when I read it back. And I wish it was, you know, like this, oh, you know, it's so genius, I'm crying about it. No, I have such a hard time reading this passage where I'm talking about tigers are not afraid. In this moment where Estrella, who is like this child that has lost her mother to, you know, like being kidnapped and abused and tortured and killed, and when they finally encounter each other and she sees her mom not like she remembers her, but rather with this sort of like, with all the violence that has been imposed in her, like on her body, to me, that breaks me every time. And I think that's why it was so taxing for me to write it, but all the more important as an anti-patriarchal, anti-colonial exercise, because I thought like, yeah, shit, it's horrible. It is very difficult for me to confront those things and to think about, I don't know if anyone else listening is going to relate, or if this is something that happens to you as well. But sometimes being in environments where we are removed from, you know, like from Latin America,
yes,
feels like there is this kind of sense of guilt. Like,
yes.
Right? Like, okay, yes. Yeah, things are shit, but it could be much worse.
Yes.
And Right. And you're like, yeah, the people that I care about and people that I don't even know are living existences that put them in constant peril. And it is no longer about like, oh, it's my mom or it's my sister or it's my friend. It's about like this sense of how fucked up it is to live as a woman, as a person of color, as, you know what I mean, in the contexts where we are from. And I have a very hard time not crying right now because I always keep being confronted with, you know, it is difficult to write about a place that you love that doesn't love you back. It is horrible. And that is something I think that can traverse you, whether you are located elsewhere or in your own country. And it breaks me every time because I think it is just like this, it is very hard to deal with that because, yeah, I mean, we can love our colonially, you know, understood nations however much we like, but there is always this implication that, you know, they don't love us back. And the more the legislation, the more the, you know, everyday violence, the more the discursive violence demonstrates that, the harder it becomes. And it is tough. I think, you know, this illusion that the researchers sort of like, no, we sort of like take out ourselves from the thing is just bullshit. It is hard. It is hard. And even though it was very taxing and it really took a lot of me to write this and to think about all these violences and the way that they are so freely exercised on our bodies and our brothers and sisters' bodies, even though it breaks me every time and I struggle every time and it left me, you know, it left me very anxious and depressed. Even then, I am still stubborn because I don't think that I can afford to not do it.
That just made me cry because
I'm wearing glasses not to give away my crying as well.
No, I asked you, I wanted to interrupt to ask you because that's probably something now I'm in the part where I'm doing my fields. Did you have to do comps or fields?
I think the systems are different, right? Like you have to do... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so right now I'm in fields and getting into fields. So my fields are in Latin American studies, which is going to be interesting. I never thought I would ever become a Latin Americanist. I'm so excited. And visual culture. But getting to the point of deciding to those fields, you know, I had to have many talks this year with, you know, my faculty members, and I'm lucky that I do think like I figured out my team, so I feel like supported and whatnot. But I would break down crying every time during a fields meeting because I was like, this is so personal, and like and that guilt that you were talking about, it's almost double for me because I left Puerto Rico because I could not get the education that I wanted there, and I'm here now trying to like divert resources to go back to the island, that way people don't have to do what I have to do. But then it's also exactly what you say, where you know you are confronting constantly the situations of everyone that's living back home through your own work, and it's like, how do I not break down every 15 minutes crying, you know, knowing what I know? And I the silver lining or whatever, as you say, is what you refer to as your stubbornness. And I relate to that. It's like, okay, well, this is me doing this as my form of activism. Me doing this is me trying to make it better, right? And I'm sure that counts for something. But as you say, it's so isolating. It is beyond isolating, especially for me. Because I have no one up here, really, and I'm the only one doing this. That's why, like I say, I get so excited whenever we talk or whenever we do things, because I'm like, oh, I'm not like alone, you know. It is really hard, but it's important. It's so important that we do it, right? And bring new perspectives, especially because the people that have been writing about this before are typically men, or you know, not Mexican women, not Puerto Rican women, you know. And as you said, one thing that I think I am being very like conscious about is not removing myself from my work. And I know it's going to give me some grief, like, because, you know, I'm going to a research university being trained by some of the best researchers, but everyone on my team is white. All of them are straight, you know, they're beyond smart. I love them so much. And they, you know, the reason why I love them is that they definitely recognize and validate me and whatnot. But it definitely feels like unless I fight for my personal lens and my personal connection to this, that it would then be desanitized if I'm not careful about it. So yeah, so thank you for sharing that because it was very warm in my heart and also important for people to hear, I think, because it's not just like horror studies or, you know, decolonial studies or feminist studies, and not to shade any of our colleagues or anyone. Everyone is doing it, you know, the way that they know how, and everyone is valid if they're doing good work. But I always feel like stakes are a little bit higher when it comes to you and me.
And, you know, like, I think half of it is also having, like, when you think about the ways in which, you know, like, this idea of the neoliberal university, for-profit type stuff that becomes this relationship between, you know, like, clients and people that supply education that I find really horrible. And that turn, I mean, it's nothing new, but it champions this sort of idea that everyone is just like their own personal genius, and that community is just like good for you to cry about how horrible things are. And then you move on, and then you could give two shits about the bonds that you have with them. And I think that forming this sort of like, you know, coalition, to quote like Maria Luone's huge inspiration also in the, you know, like in the work, you know, these modes of community are also modes of resisting. I think I was very lucky in that, even though I do not have like, I had some Latino, colleagues. And of course it is very enriching to discuss with them, but I think I was very lucky in that I had mentors that understood that sort of the virtue of not thinking through it through a hierarchy, but through a collaborative process. And I am just so grateful for stuff like Mai, in which we're going to be collaborating together.
Yes.
For people like, you know, like Professor Anna Backman Rogers, who was my my mentor throughout this, and you know, like one of the people that began Mai, and my other advisors, of course, David Martin Jones, who also works with Latin American, you know, film, but he's based in Scotland. So to me, it was very enriching that all of these sort of turns, right, kept to me, demonstrating to me that even though it was, you know, within that context of the university, that coalition was possible. And I find such tremendous power in that, right? Because diluting the importance of coalition and of community within these processes that are very difficult, is also not recognizing that it is our way of resisting in these modes. Maybe we would be better off if we decided to keep ourselves outside of it. But the reality is that we will never be outside of it. Our research is part of ourselves as much as we are part of the research. And I think, and I don't mean to disrespect anyone that believes otherwise, my personal posture is that, you know, that sort of illusion of neutrality is something that only, you know, white dudes can allow themselves. Because right. They have been told that they are the neutral point of view forever. Yeah. So I think that the more that we see, and that's why I value so much like dialogues like these. I'm so, so grateful that we could do it finally. Because it is just testament that, you know, like you say, it's not only horror studies or feminist studies or Latin American studies or decolonial studies, but it is a whole that traverses from many different, you know, like, many different points of entry. And the more that we learn to see that, I think the better chance we stand at, you know, facing all the horrible shit.
Absolutely. That's so well said. So to begin to wrap up, I have one more question. And you're going to hate it. I'm sorry. But mainly because having interviewed people about their books, I know that this is always like the least favorite question. But, you know, you wrote this 300 page beautiful thing. But it's like, what do you wish? Well, so you can answer this either way. Like, what do you wish you would have done differently, or what do you feel like was left out that you hope to pursue, or what do you hope people build off of from it? Like, so like, what's the afterlife of the book? What do you think? What are your hopes and dreams?
Well, first, something that I left off that I really think deserves its own study, as was sort of like mentioned before, is Brazilian horror film. I think, I mean, there are accounts of it, of course, and there are wonderful people doing stuff on this. One of them is Beatriz Saldana, who's also going to be part of our dossier. I'm really excited about it. And I think these reevaluations of, you know, feminist and female filmmaking within the genre are so important. So I've been thinking about like how to pursue that. One thing that I think I wish I would have done differently is that I would have left. I mean, of course, I don't think I'm ever going to be at that point, but I would have given myself less shit. Like I feel like I do that on a constant.
I agree. Your book is like, I don't think when I write my book, it'll be good, but I don't think it'll be as good as yours. It's like, you know, English in a way that I don't even know English.
That's very kind. I really appreciate that. I would have given myself less shit. And I think that's also something so in tune with what we were saying a little bit before, right? Like imposter syndrome is always your, you know, like that thing on your shoulder constantly as a PhD student. But as a PhD student that happens to be in a minoritized group, often that sort of doubles down. And as a person that exists as a woman, it's like tripled. So in a way, I think that I would have allowed myself to feel a little bit, you know, more, because when it became too much, I just like ugly cried. I remember we're having like, if there's anyone from my listening to this, they will remember this very well. We had a board meeting and I hadn't been, you know, in Mexico for a while. And it was just like, everything was just, you know, I was wearing my heart on my sleeve. And all of these writing about violence and hopelessness and, you know, like the pandemic was just raging at its horrible peak. And I realized how badly I treated myself throughout the process. And I just ugly cried during that meeting because I was talking about like how much I missed my parents and how I had like, you know, this ring that my dad gave me last time I was in Mexico, like as a lucky charm. It was this ring that he had. Like, I remember very well from when I was a child, and I always thought, like, I want that one. And he gave it to me last time I was there. And I just broke down crying like a baby. And I was like, this is, you know, like, all these fucking sacrifices that they had to make, and all these things, like, put me here, and I'm treating myself like crap. So I think that I would have valued a little bit more, you know, that time of taking it easy on myself. That's what I would have done differently. You know, to also see these instances of vulnerability. And I think that doing this work really taught me that being vulnerable and being open and sort of like putting it out there in such a personal way, it's also a way of making politics. So I think that even though I would have treated myself better, I think that the result was perhaps, you know, I don't know the desired result, but it was something that I can feel like I was very transparent and put myself like completely out there in the work. So I guess that the method was not the best, but I think that in the end, it ended up being something that I want to expand. I want to take it in other directions, to think about Mexican figures as well and other ways of contemporary violence, but I don't think that I'm just there yet because of how harsh it was. So I'm not sure that I'm ready to discuss, like, you know, that type of raw violence, not now, but I think that the ethics of that violence I really want to revise. So kind of in a nutshell where I would like to be heading.
Awesome. Well, you have deserved this moment. I know that you've been celebrating and I'm so happy for you and I'm just so proud of you. And also I've been, you know, reading it many times carefully because I know it's going to guide me in my process too. So thank you for, you know, giving that as well to me. And yeah, I guess we'll begin to wrap up that, or I guess I never know how to end podcasts. I want to thank you so much for taking time out to doing this with me. I know that this is a bit of your, you got a lot going on. And so I'm just so glad that you were able to finally sit down with me. So thank you so much for that.
Oh, and thank you. It was just so, I'm just over the moon that we could finally do this. And I'm really, really grateful that you invited me over. I just think that there's so much, I mean, I treasure and I appreciate so much what you're doing. And I want you to know that I think that there is such a need for us to, you know, take over. But, you know, like there is such a need for us to address these difficult matters, but not do it alone, you know?
Yeah.
And I am just very, you know, I feel like, you know, this, aside from what the listeners are like now perceiving about a relationship, I really do treasure a great deal to have you, not only, you know, in my scholarly, but also personal life. I think that, you know, we lift each other up, and that's really important shit, man. Like,
yeah,
especially now, and especially in this sort of environment, it's something that we can't take for granted.
Yeah, I don't even have, you know, when you were talking about, you said that you had some Latino, some Latinx colleagues when you were doing your dissertation. I'm the only one in my program. So when I say, like, you're like always the person, I think, when I go to regarding Latin American anything, because the only other person I go to is my mentor, and I'm kind of sick of going to him like, hey, rah, rah, rah. So yeah, no, so it's very mutual. I would be alone if I didn't have you, honestly. So thank you so much for that. And I guess we'll just wrap up here. So.